Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to be talking about the Flexera open source report and a bit of controversy. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps, episode 521, recorded March 13th, 2019, Flexera Open Source Report. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the simplest cloud platform for developers and teams. Deploy, manage, and scale cloud applications faster and more efficiently with DigitalOcean. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. And by Smart Deploy. Smart Deploy allows IT departments to re-image unlimited computer models from one golden image. Search their library for your models and get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and be unaware of it, projects you might want to play with right after this show. This is going to be a slightly different kind of show today, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Simon Phipps. Simon, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to see you. It's a little bit earlier than usual because all you over in the US land, so we're going to summer while we're still in winter here in Europe. So I've actually got daylight out of the window. It's really quite unusual.
Wow. Yeah, well, you know, we just got to get rid of DST entirely. Let's go back to just straight time zones like they're supposed to be. You know, this whole thing is just too nutty. And in fact, yeah, if you go to time... If you go to timeanddate.com, one of the links at the top of the page there is upcoming and past time zone DST changes. And the page is chaotic. I mean, it's not just twice a year in
a line. It could be worse, you know, because the proposal in Europe is to let every country pick their own time zone. And imagine in the US, if you all get, I mean, it's already pretty random because you've got your southern states deciding to opt out of DST. But imagine if every state picked its own time zone.
That's just horrible. That would be rough. Anyway, and I am speaking to you from beautiful downtown Santa Monica. I'm back on site at ZipRecruiter, and I'm in yet another room. If you're watching the video, I'm in another room that has a beach theme. This one's, I just put my head in front of it. Coronado. There we go. So it's a giant wave. If you're not watching the video, you can't see that. And I should also say it's an electric wave. If you look real carefully, there's an electric switch right in the middle. I'll try not to touch that while we're taping the show. I have no idea what that'll do to the wave. Anyway, so today's show is a little bit different than most shows. This show is going to be about Flexera's open source license compliance report. And the show was brought to me a few weeks ago, and I've been describing it before I actually got my hands on the actual report as something that would talk about the relative CVEs in open source software, things like that, the dangers of that, and maybe license compliance, things like that. As I read the report, I find out that it's more of a white paper to managers about trying to figure out the business risks from using open source software. Now, Simon, you and I go way back on the open source world. In fact, you're president of the OSI right now, right?
I am still president of OSI for another month or so until I get the opportunity to hand the baton over to a new intake. We have our elections on the go at the moment, and if you're an OSI member, which of course all our listeners and viewers are, you need to go vote. That's my plug. But yeah, I've been doing this for a little while now.
Yeah, and you were an open source guy, advocate, whatever the title was, for Sun for many years too, right?
Indeed. I got Java open source and Unix open source and a load of identity middleware open source and a load of compilers open source. A great achievement for me this week is I've finally got an apache.org email address because I've been invited to join the PMC for NetBeans, which is now an Apache project. So nice. That all dates back to the Sun days as well.
Nice. So Dave McLaughlin's coming on in a few minutes. He works with Flexera, is going to be talking about what his visions and risks to using open source is. But what do you and I see as the biggest risks to using open source in our projects?
The biggest challenges to using open source are when businesses decide that they're going to treat it as a natural resource that they can just strip mine. Open source, when you join the community and use the code, is incredibly valuable. It lets you just invest in the things that are of benefit to you, and then the rest of the community, as they benefit from your contribution, also maintain your code for you. They check it for security. They typically will review it for license and compliance risks. So when you're a member of a community, I regard open source as a massive benefit. And the only people who've really got any risks from using open source are people who try and cheat and who try and steal it.
And I fully concur with that. And also, you know, we hear occasionally about security issues in open source software. And, you know, if you go through the list of CVEs and stuff, you can see that sometimes things break. But if you look at the number of lines of code executed every day versus the number of problems we've had from open source, most of the issues seem to be misconfigurations or bringing too many things together that were wrong or whatever. And license compliance also seems to be fairly low issue. The only thing I remember was like TiVo had to make their kernel open because they use some GPL software. So I think the GPL virus vector is probably the biggest issue around license compliance. Would you agree?
I wouldn't dream of using those terms to describe the issue, Randall. I think that the GPL is a great license for keeping a level playing field in communities where everybody is subject to the same terms. There are still some license compliance issues. There's a big project at the Linux Foundation at the moment called OpenChain, which is all about helping the different vendors in a supply chain declare their use of open source software so that the next vendor along the supply chain can quickly become comfortable that the software is properly licensed and that they are complying with the terms. I'd say that for businesses that are not strip mining open source, compliance has become a whole lot easier. There's a whole load of open source tools. There are some great open source projects like OpenChain. At OSI, we're hosting a new project which is helping automate the process of license detection. So I would say that it's pretty much an addressed problem. And the companies that came into the space a number of years ago to try and monetize fear, uncertainty, and doubt, like people like Black Duck, have had to move on and move into other areas. For example, they're now monetizing fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the IoT sector and in open hardware rather than exclusively in open source software now. So I do think that compliance remains an important issue. You know, the license says some things. If you're using software under the the BSD or MIT licenses, they require you to maintain the historic copyright statements of all the previous contributors. And to be in compliance with the BSD license, you have to make sure that you are preserving all the copyright statements. And I think the businesses that are not strip miners, that are actually community members and are acting responsibly, they do the right thing. They build compliance into their continuous integration server. They use open source tools to make sure that they're complying. And I regard it as largely a solved problem these days.
Okay. Well, I'm sure Dave McLaughlin's sitting over there in his chair going, when do I get to defend myself? When do I get to give my alternate point of view? So, but before we bring him on, hopefully he's still there. Before we bring him on, I do have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. Easily run production applications with DigitalOcean, a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. Whether you're running one virtual machine or 10,000, DigitalOcean has you covered with the flexibility to customize standard or CPU-optimized droplets. Set up SSD-based virtual machines in 55 seconds or less. Capture backups and snapshots. DigitalOcean is designed for developers. The easy-to-use control panel and API lets developers spend more time coding and less time managing their infrastructure. Use Kubernetes to improve availability, scalability, and resource efficiency of containerized apps. One-click apps skip the installation and configuration and deploy one of the pre-built images. Django, Docker, GitLab, LAMP, MySQL, Node.js, Ruby on Rails, and more. And DigitalOcean recently introduced managed databases for Postgres, so you can launch your database with the push of a button while DigitalOcean handles maintenance and updates. Free daily backups with point-in-time recovery, standby nodes with automated failover, and end-to-end security. Over 2,000 open-source tutorials available for developers. Industry-leading price performance. Access the computing resources you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. Know what you'll pay monthly with a simple, flat pricing structure. And included at no additional cost. 99.99% uptime SLA. Cloud firewalls. Full DNS management. 12 global data centers. Free round-the-clock tech support. Join over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, and including StunEdge.com, who rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. That's do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. DigitalOcean, trusted by businesses, loved by developers. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Floss Weekly. And let's go ahead and bring on Dave. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm calling in from Boulder, Colorado.
And I hear you're having a bit of a storm there?
Yes. So I think it's national news. Most of the schools and businesses are closed in the area. There's a bomb cyclone descending on Denver as we speak. So looking out the window, it looks like the winds haven't started yet, but the snow has, and it looks like we're going to get quite a bit. So we're bracing.
Cool. Well, Simon and I got the first chance to take the mic, so we gave our opinion on the risks of using open source software in projects. Why don't you give us your bullet points and expand on that?
Sure. Absolutely. Thanks. You know, I agree a lot with what Simon said. I've been in the industry for about 12, 13 years now, the open source side. I've been in the software industry for over 30 years. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen is, you know, from 12 years ago, the percentage of organizations that are using open source in the development of their products and their main internal IT projects, et cetera, has just, you know, grown to a really high percentage. You know, I think everyone's using open source today. And obviously, you know, early in the industry, we looked at ways, how do we monetize services around open source software? Because it's free. And I think most organizations got into open source initially because, you know, there were no associated license fees. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this comment about fear, uncertainty, and doubt is absolutely true. How do we get to organizations and say, listen, if you're not complying with GPL, you've got a major issue. You got to deal with it. And so we looked at it that way. But, you know, some of the comments from people like Heather Meeker, Jelaine Lovejoy, you know, over the years have shown, like Simon said, that the GPL is a good license. It keeps a level playing field. And so I think what's more important now is addressing the two issues that you brought up, Randall, which are license compliance and managing security issues around using libraries that your developers do not create themselves. So we have associated with compliance this concept of copyright infringement. And so if you're using code that you did not write, you don't give the correct attribution, like Simon mentioned with the BSD and the MIT license, then mm-hmm. you've got a potential copyright infringement issue. So I think that's a concern. You know, that's a concern for a lot of IP attorneys, general counsels, with the rise of open source in their organizations. And security is a very complex issue. You know, when we talk to customers, they ask about it all the time. How, you know, as a company that provides solutions for managing open source, how do we manage the associated security issues?
Wow. And so, like I said, I read the paper and there was a lot of, it seems to be addressed more not to technical geeks like me, it's more addressed to managers. So what's the gap there? Well, I probably already know what the gap is, but why is this paper important for people to read that are in positions of ability to do something about it?
I think it, like I said, I think it fits exactly with what Simon was talking about. That, you know, the opening point of our paper is that when we go into an audit And we asked the organization that we're doing the audit for, and let me explain what an audit is. So an organization provides code to us, and our job is then to review the code and build for them a bill of material of third-party components, both open source, freeware, you know, commercial components, anything they didn't write. That's our end goal. And when we enter into this, you know, arrangement, we will ask them, what open source do you know you're using, right? And so you would expect that developers would be managing these assets, especially if they don't write them, you know, for upgrade purposes, for security purposes, et cetera. But we're finding only about 2% of the open source is disclosed versus what we find. So we're finding 98% more. And so to Simon's comment about organizations are now strip mining and they're just throwing, you know, everything in the kitchen sink into their code, open source has, you know, on the positive side, the ability to innovate, you know, to get to market faster, et cetera. But it also has the challenges, I like to use the word liability, of managing that asset. And if you don't manage it, right, there are potential side effects, security, copyright infringement, legal issues, et cetera. So that's really what this paper was about.
When you're talking about 2%, that sounds extremely low to me, because I bet you could go to the CTO of ZipRecruiter and he would know at least 90% of the open source that's being used.
Right.
Is that not true anywhere else?
So this is really interesting. So if I were to go download 5 open source projects, and this is purely hypothetical. This is not based on any fact or anything.
Okay.
But if I were to download 5 open source projects, and let's say they were under the Apache BSD MIT license, one of them was a GPL library, and I downloaded it, and then I created a document internally. I shared it with my management, and I said, so I've got these 4 licenses. I've got these 5 open source components, right? If we did an audit on that code, what we would find out is that the open source developer may have gone to Stack Overflow and lifted some code. Now, Stack Overflow is changing to MIT, but previously the code was under a copyleft license called the Creative Commons Sharealike license. So if this was an MIT project, it's possible that there was the responsibility to provide that source code, to share that source code in the product if I distribute it. We may end up finding that in those 5 downloaded packages, that there may be 20, 30, 40 different sources of open source that are beyond just those 5 projects and additional licenses. And so the difficult issue for organizations is not, you know, downloading Apache Struts and knowing that you've got Apache Struts. It's downloading things that contain other components that have other copyrights, other licenses, other potential security issues.
Well, if the publisher of the open source project, the aggregate project, believes they are in compliance and state that they're in compliance with everything that's on their upstream licenses, wouldn't that suffice?
So I can give one real world example. A few years ago, we were doing an audit and we found a piece of code that had been contributed to a project. It had gone against, the project had a set of, contribution requirements, you know, guidelines, whatnot. And someone had accidentally, we believe, contributed code. And the thing that was interesting about it, the license that the code had been contributed under was incompatible with the core license. We found this during an audit. We went back to the project's owner and he immediately fixed it. So he didn't know about it. And so that's just one example. And so the concept here, that you're proposing is that as a project, if I'm owning an open source project, that I know that I've, that everything I've got in there is in compliance and, that we're complying and that we've got all the correct attributions, et cetera. And we're finding that to, to be the opposite. The other thing that's interesting is, and, I really applaud what the GitHub community has done. When you go create a project, an open source project on GitHub, they will recommend to you, you know, that you license your code to protect yourself and obviously to protect the IP. And they'll make suggestions, you know, MIT, BSD, whatever, you know, to help you with the licensing. But if you go to GitHub and you start, you know, doing research on open source projects, there's still many, and I know there's statistics on this, there's still many projects that don't have licenses that you can download and use. So imagine this situation. So I'm a developer. I've been given a task. I've got a deadline. I got to meet it. And I go out and I find this project that does 90% what I need to do. All I need to do is modify a little bit, integrate it into my code. So it's going to save me a bunch of time. And I don't know anything about open source licensing, right? My company doesn't have an open source policy. I haven't been educated on it. So I just know how to use GitHub and I know how to find code. So I download it, right? And the author has not licensed it. So in other words, there's no explicit license, and I put it in my code. So what kind of a problem or liability does that create for my organization? I've now used code that may or may not have copyright notices on it. It doesn't have any explicit license terms. And under U.S. copyright law, I'm thinking the U.S., but I'm sure this is worldwide, this code is protected by copyright law. You know, if this author wants to come back and sue me later for incorrect, you know, attribution or whatever, that potential exists. So now, I'm the head of the legal department for this company, and we do an audit for some reason, and we decided we want to manage our open source better, and we start finding all of these things. What kind of liability does this create for my organization? So, you know, back to your original question, you know, if we pay attention to what we're downloading and paying attention to the licenses of those components, we're probably doing a pretty good job. But what we found is that once you go under the hood and you really start going deep on looking what's inside of open source projects, you find other open source, other licenses, other potential security issues.
So, Dave, unfortunately, I don't recognize that world you're describing. I think the chance of finding that there is inappropriately licensed software in an open source project like one and hosted at the Apache Software Foundation or within a project like LibreOffice, I think the chances of finding that incorrectly licensed code that some developer just grabbed out of a web page are negligible. I do think that used to happen in corporations where people mistook learning resources for places that they could take code from. But I'm really not sure that happens anymore. Are you seriously saying that we should mistrust a project like Apache HTTPD on the grounds that JRandom Hacker has cut code out of Stack Overflow and pasted it in with no regard for the license?
No, but I do think you have to look at the project on a project by project basis. If the Apache Software Foundation did have an issue a number of years ago, I can't remember what it was, 6-7 years ago, where they did have a license leak in, they discovered it, they fixed it. They did around Tomcat. They had gotten contributions from Sun Microsystems. They did not remove the Sun Microsystems copyright notices, and the agreement that they had with Sun was that they were relinquishing their rights under copyright law, and the Apache Software Foundation had full rights to copyright the code and own it. That created a bit of confusion in the market because people were using Apache code that was under the Apache software license, and in the code itself were comments that said this is copyright by Sun and it's under a Sun license. So that created a lot of confusion. But Apache Software Foundation has done a great job and they're very diligent about it. What I'm more concerned about is if an organization is not managing the open source as it comes into the organization, and they're not doing any type of scanning at all, right? Then there is this risk that the developer is getting code from organizations that don't have as much diligence as the Apache Software Foundation. And I still believe there's that potential for you know, these unseen licenses that are in your code?
You know, when we introduced blogging at Sun Microsystems all those years ago, one of the things we said was that we hire people because they're smart and experienced. And we don't need to have every blog post checked by Sun Legal, because we hire smart people who've got good judgment. And I think the same these days applies to open source developers, doesn't it? The people who are not just strip miners understand that code is under licenses and belongs to someone. And the chances of somebody who's involved, so you've been talking specifically about open source projects, the chances of somebody who's in an open source project doing that have become vanishingly small, surely.
Yes, you know what, I agree with you on that, and this brings up a really good point. It's kind of the issue of trust and the things that you control. Another thing that you'll notice in this paper is that the amount of M&A due diligence work that we're doing is increasing, and it's been increasing year after year. A number of years ago, I was talking with a firm that was did open source due diligence as part of their practice. And they said over the previous 5 years, we would get involved in doing an acquisition. And as part of the due diligence, we would say part of what we do is looking at open source software. And companies would go, why? We don't understand. But over the years, companies now look at open source due diligence as just, you know, standard operating procedure. It really has become, there's very few technology acquisitions today that don't look at it. And my point is this, that at a company like Sun Microsystems, at organizations that do, training, hire the best engineers, they have processes in place to manage third-party software, and they have processes in place, like you mentioned, OpenChain, to manage open source components that come in through the supply chain, et cetera. With this education comes trust. I've educated the people, now I've got to trust them, just like you, in your blog example, right? I got to trust that they don't put something in a blog article that's going to embarrass us, so we don't have to have legal counsel review everyone. Those organizations, yes, right? But if you're going to acquire technology, you don't necessarily know what their practices are. You don't know how trusted, how trained, how good, how intelligent these engineers are at the organization that built this technology. So, you know, I think what I've seen is this, is that organizations trust their developers. Organizations that acquire technology have no way of knowing if they can trust. And so they have to do this M&A due diligence. I also think, on top of that, I mean, when you look at the pie in this report, there's a what percentage we do M&A and what we do, what we call baseline. There are a lot of organizations that are getting to the point today, and I think you'd agree with me about this, that they've read about open source, they know they're using it, but they don't feel like they're doing a good job managing it. And the first step to managing it is really getting a good understanding of what they're using. And they could go to their developers and say, hey, let's, you know, tell me everything you're using in the code. But developers come and go. Even if I'm working on a section of code, if there was, previous contributors to this code, I don't know if they brought third-party components in. I may not know. So, you know, doing an audit can be extremely valuable. It gives you a good insight into what open source components you're using, what kind of license obligations you have. Just by knowing the names of the open source components and projects, you can find related security information, like if you're using Apache Struts 12, the bug that affected Equifax, if you've got a customer-facing portable Struts in it, doing an audit could reveal something like that that maybe even your developers don't know. So I think there's a lot of value in doing these audits to get a baseline. And let me just add one more thought to that. We do something, I think, pretty unique at Flexera. And I can't speak for my competitors. I can speak for RogueWave OpenLogic, where I came from previously. We took an approach previously at OpenLogic where when we did an audit, we would audit every line of code, every audit we did. Flexera has really three different types of audits that we offer. We have a forensic audit where we will go down to the code snippet and we'll tell you if people have copied and pasted. We will do a complete overview audit, not going down to the code snippet level, but finding every, you know, complete component that we can find. And then we can do a very fast, prioritized audit, if you will. So if we have an M&A situation where we've got a very tight deadline, and we need to find if there's any copyleft licenses or components that have any security issues as part of the M&A due diligence, you know, we can go very, very quickly and create a very high-level baseline for the organization. And so we're not saying that one size fits all when it comes from, you know, comes to auditing, but we're seeing enough, you know, business, and we're still seeing it grow, that organizations, you know, either want to do this M&A due diligence or they want to get a good handle on their open source for management purposes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to jump in here in a minute or two and talk about the technologies that you're actually using in order to that sort of auditing stuff, because that sort of stuff fascinates me. But before we do that, I have another very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Smart Deploy. Smart Deploy allows IT departments to re-image unlimited computer models from one golden image. They offer one-click user data migration for simplified migrations, zero-touch network deployment, imaging over the internet, and application deployment to make your project stress-free. Whether you have 50 or 50,000 computers at your company, their patented device driver injection technology combined with technician-built driver packages called platform packs make your life easier. Their library of over 1,200 platform packs includes Lenovo, HP, and Dell, and all other major OEMs. When you need to support a new model, just download the pack and deploy your golden image to any business-class computer. Smart Deploy is the most reliable, easy-to-use solution that has been trusted to deploy over 2.2 million endpoints. It is the first and only solution to offer imaging over Wi-Fi, meaning you can now manage your remote users and satellite offices without being connected to the same network. Deploy images, apps, and updated drivers to your endpoints via the cloud using Dropbox, Google Drive, OneDrive, or OneDrive for Business cloud storage. Step-by-step wizards will guide you through the process and complicated steps like SysPrep are handled for you automatically. Include an answer file to automate tasks like domain join and computer naming for hands-free, zero-touch deployment. No ramp-up or training necessary. Migrate 100 computers to Windows 10 in under an hour with out-of-box multicast support. Their Seattle-based support team is made up of imaging and Windows experts, and they're just an email or phone call away. Companies like Nintendo, UCLA, and Nissan turn to Smart Deploy to make the dreaded task of computer imaging a bit less painful. And right now, Smart Deploy is giving our audience 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/floss. If you work at a company with 50 to 50,000 computers, head to smartdeploy.com/FLOSS to get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. And we thank Smart Deploy for supporting Floss Weekly. Okay, so talk to me. Okay, so part of this has to be an automated solution. Part of this has to be that you're finding this non-compliant stuff with some tools and technologies. Can you talk about those?
Yes. So we're a product and services organization. And what I mean by that is a company can outsource the auditing to us. They can hire us. We'll come in and review their code. We'll bill them, build for them a bill of materials, a list of CVEs associated with the components, the version information, all of the license and copyright information, any embedded code, you know, within, you know, bundled within components. So we'll do that as a service. But the tool that we use is something called Flexera Code Insight. And that is, you can also license that tool. And what we recommend to a lot of our audit customers is let us baseline your code. Let's do all the heavy lifting, find all these, you know, hard to find nuggets in your code base, and then purchase the tool, license the tool from us, and continue to audit your code on a going forward basis. We've used this term get clean and stay clean. So the technology is a software, we refer to it as a software composition analysis tool. What it does is you have your source code. It inspects each of the files in source code that's sitting on the file system, as it goes through, it looks for a number of things. So there's a number of algorithms in the product. A lot of what we find is based on regular expressions and text searches. So we're looking for the term general public license. We're looking for GPL. We're looking for Stack Overflow. We're looking for copyright notices. So the product is very good at parsing out copyright information. In addition to that, we have checksums for literally millions of open source components and files, probably hundreds of millions of open source files. And so we can tell if any of your code has a checksum match, full source match, if you will, on a file-by-file basis and a project basis. And then we have fingerprinting technology, which will go in and look within a file and see if, one, two, three lines of code, within 50 lines of code, actually match checksums that we have stored in our database. And so we run this technology. It has a user interface that allows you then to review each of the results. It has hundreds of thousands of automated rules. So when I run across the code base, a certain percent, and it completely depends on the code base, anywhere from 20% up to 80% of the code base can automatically be identified. So like, for example, in Java, there's millions and millions of jars out in Maven, in Maven repositories today, and we have checksums for those, so we can identify those very, very quickly. So if I was scanning, for example, a Java project that was made up of mostly open source jars, probably just scan it and the automated results would tell me what those components are and what their license is. If I've written code in JavaScript or C or PHP, it's very easy to modify those, and so there's little, and it's real easy to take projects and take pieces of them. So when it's piecemeal, it's a little bit more difficult to identify. But our product will provide the indicators. They'll say, hey, we see something in the code down in this section. Go look at it. Once we see what the copyright is and maybe a README file, we're able to identify and add it to the bill of materials.
And Simon's yelling in my ear, so I got to ask this question. Is this open source?
No, it's not. It's a commercial product.
Those are two different terms. You can have a commercial product that's open source.
Yes. No, it is not open source.
You have any intention to make it open source?
No, there are no plans at this time to make it open source.
Okay. Does the history of this product include any open source components prior to your proprietary stuff added to it?
Yes. And in the product itself, in the user documentation, there's a full attribution and licensing section that talks about all the third-party components. Probably one of the most prominent components is, in addition, I really focused in on scanning when I talked about FlexNet Code Insight. We have a complete open source governance and management platform as well that includes the ability for organizations to develop policies. So, for example, if they're concerned about GPL or AGPL or SSPL, for example, we could set a policy that says if anything is found in the component, automatically flag it, send an email alert out or add it to a workflow, integrate that with Jira, for example. So, and built into the product, getting around to my point, is we have a workflow engine, and it's based on JBPM.
Okay.
Which is an open source project.
Have you contributed back upstream for anything you find in the parts you're using?
I don't know the answer to that question. I apologize. I've been with Flexer for 1 year, and okay. I have not been asked that question, and I have not heard that question answered, so I apologize ahead of time. It's possible we have. I just don't know.
And there are other players in this same space of scanners that are all open source. Are you familiar with them?
Yes. In my practice previously at OpenLogic, we used similar proprietary technology, and we used Fossology, for example. I was an early beta tester of Fossology before it went public. A lot of the guys who developed it were right here in Fort Collins, Colorado, at Hewlett-Packard. It's now part of the Linux Foundation. And of course, Fossa which has commercial components on top of their API library. They've got some interesting sets of technology that are open source as well. Some of our other competitors, I'm not aware of their open source offerings, if they have any. There's a Bay Area, San Francisco area based organization, NextV. NextV is primarily a services organization, has some products, and they open source some of their components as well. And I've taken a look at those.
Okay, well, it's still, I'm still a little shaken up here, and I'm glad Sam told me to ask you that question, because if he came on, he'd probably be yelling it. So given that you're working around many, many open source organizations, and that's part of your primary business model is being able to audit open source for people, at least one part of Flexar anyway, you must have seen the leverage that comes from open sourcing a project. And why would you not consider open sourcing your scanning tool?
Again, I wish I had a better answer for that. So like I said, I've been here for a year. The technology that we use was developed by a company called Palomita. The technology was first started being developed something like 15 years ago. That was a Bay Area company that Flexera acquired 2.5 years ago. That obviously, when they got into the business, they had the choice at the time to say, are we going to create commercial technologies that we're going to license commercially only and not make open source, or do we want to do this, like Linux, like Red Hat does. At the time, their decision was to do it as a commercial offering. I am not aware at this time of Flexera having any discussions to change that model.
So why is that, Dave? I mean, I started the show by talking about people strip mining open source. I've seen companies like Black Duck and Palomita and OpenLogic come into our community and spread fear, uncertainty, and doubt about open source developers, say that open source is fundamentally risky, place attacks on mergers and acquisitions, fail to participate in open projects like the one that ScanCode is producing and able to run a commercial business on. And I have to ask, after all these years, why would anybody trust a company that claims to do open source audits and yet claims that open source is not good enough for their business?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it comes down to business basics and business philosophy. And I think for some organizations, I think delivering their software as open source makes perfect sense. I think 15 years ago, that decision wasn't as well understood. And, I'm just speculating now. But I would think that, part of it is inertia. I mean, if, I created a commercial product 15 years ago that was designed, to assist people with the management of open source software, that and I had, done it for years, it would be a difficult decision for my organization to, to change from that commercial to an open source model. One of the things that we looked at, for example, at RogueWave, was we had an open source scanner, and we decided to take the product. RogueWave decided to take the product off the market. At the time, there was an internal discussion: do we now release the source code to the open source community? And the team said, the code is, we can't just release it wholesale. It has hard-coded proprietary information in it. It has hard-coded customer information in it. And the cost to then change the code and prepare it, in a way that it would be useful to the open source community could be very costful. And costly, and, what's the benefit to us? So I think those are just some of the things that go into the business decision. I mean, I can also tell you, I was at Netscape Communications when one of my peers went to senior management and proposed that we take the Netscape Navigator and open source it. And then the Mozilla community was created. So that was a change in model, and I think it worked wonderfully. So what I'm saying is I believe it's a business decision. And my role in the organization, I'm the manager of solutions engineering. I have not been involved in, you know, in business strategy and discussing these types of things. If I was and I was aware of them, I probably could give you a little bit better answer.
So are you, do you follow our show regularly, Dave?
Say that again?
Do you follow Floss Weekly regularly?
No, I do not.
Because I think you need to have some words with the PR professional who set you up with the show. This is a show about open source and free software. And the presenters on the show are very committed to software freedom as a concept. And I'm very surprised to have a company that has absolutely no grasp of the business value of open source and free software coming and pitching a commercial product on the show and giving a marketing pitch for their merger and acquisition scanning service. I'm very surprised that a company would have the discourtesy to pitch a session on a show that is about free and open source software and presented by free and open source software professionals and people who spend every week exploring the fundamentals of free and open source software and the business value of it. Really, I'm shocked that you came on this show, and I wonder why you did.
You wonder why I came on. So, you know, I believe we were invited to talk. I don't know exactly how this was arranged. I do believe that open source software is, you know, I've been in the industry for, like I said, over 12 years. I agree with all your points about the value of open source software and the high value to it. But, you know, I think it has to be managed like any type of asset. And, you know, what I'm seeing now, you know, with your organization, the Open Source Initiative, what's going on in the Linux Foundation with SPDX, OpenChain. I just saw this announcement from Finos, the FinTech open source group, about their compliance workbook that they're putting together. And, you know, I met recently with a company up in Redmond, Washington, and we talked about a new project that's starting to get a bit of groundswell called Clearly Defined. And I believe all of these organizations, which are, you know, part of free and open source organizations and have commercial entities that are part of, are all part of a drive by the industry that uses open source software to have more of a solution around managing and governance and managing the challenges and risks of open source, you know, through these consortiums and these organizations. But I think the reason that exists is that, you know, when you're in a business of building products, and more of these products are becoming dependent on open source libraries, you need good, solid products, and in some cases, commercial products to help you manage those tools. So, I mean, I thought this was an opportunity to come on and really talk about how we help organizations manage the use of open source software. I personally, I don't believe in this fear, uncertainty, and doubt. I believe in the use of all third-party components, there's risks. If I'm using a commercial component developing my product, right, I've got to comply with that license. I've got to pay my license fees. That component can have security issues in it, just like open source can. And I need to manage that. We've seen a history in the software industry of purchasing departments, you know, developing these great negotiators. They've got you know, all these processes and places to manage any third-party components that come into my code. But we haven't seen a real parallel in open source. We've seen engineering departments being allowed to just, you know, bring the code in. I think this, what we do is provide a service to help you manage open source responsibly. And so I hope my message is that what we're doing is a, is is helping with the growth of open source, is helping people manage it, use it responsibly. I don't want to scare people away from using open. I think people should use as much open source as possible, but I think they should use it responsibly and they should manage it.
Well, we're out of time, so that's a weird place to end the show, I think. But I do want to say I respect you for staying with the line of questioning and not hanging up on us when we got a little more correct, because you could have easily done that. This is a Skype call. You know, you just push a button and it's done. So yeah. I want to thank you for at least respecting the process enough so that we could ask you the heavy questions. And maybe some of the things that Simon said, you'll be able to take away back to your group and, you know, consider at least open sourcing part of your project. Maybe not the parts you can't, you know, like you said, you have some proprietary stuff in there. And that's reasonable to have. Well, Simon hates it, but it's called open core, where you could have some sort of thing the community can help and build and then have some proprietary parts. And in the chat room, it was discussed that, you know, you could easily sell the service of running the open source code, because your expertise would then be in how to interpret the results. And so this is the ideal mix for a service company built around an open source product. So yes. Please consider that as well.
Great. Well, Randall, Simon, thank you so much for having me today. It was a pleasure talking to you. Tough questions, but good questions. So much appreciated. So now, since we first started talking, now in Boulder, Colorado, we have about an inch of snow on the ground. So it's really starting to come down here. So thank you so much. Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks. That was Dave McLaughlin from Flexera. I hate to say, what did you think, Simon? Because you'll go on another rant.
You know,
I need that time to be able to go find the... Yeah, I need that time to be able to go find that problem list. Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. I'm listening to Dave there saying, you know, all the reasons why a company that was started Jeff started the company in 2003 when open source was already, well established. And it was the managing director of Palomino was Mark Tolliver, who was an executive at Sun Microsystems, who understood what open source was completely. The fact that he's saying that they can't open source their code because it's so difficult, I was part of the team that open sourced Solaris. It took us 6 years to do the due diligence, and we did it. We open sourced Java. We open sourced a whole load of Spark compilers. We open sourced the Spark silicon, for goodness sake. There is absolutely no reason why a sufficiently motivated company can't do those things. So I found that pretty disingenuous, and I was managing to avoid yelling anything into my open microphone at the time. this whole sector is one where I have a limited capacity for respect. Black Duck, Palomino, OpenLogic. It's a sector that has seen a lot of shrinkage as useful open source projects have come into the marketplace. We've seen a lot of supply chain work done by things like OpenChain, as I mentioned. We've seen open source projects like ScanCode come along that are getting integrated in with CI. And as a consequence, both Black Duck and Palomino had to be acquired by larger companies who shared no values with the free software movement. The whole thing seems to me to be opportunistic. People from outside our community coming in to monetize us. And honestly, I detest it.
Yeah, and I do want to say in my defense, being the showrunner here, that I was approached by their PR people. And that's how a lot of these shows happen these days. And only the title of the talk was given to me. And I thought, well, if they're contacting me, it's something about, having some sort of details about current state of security and licensing in open source. So I booked the show, and I didn't get the actual paper until a week and a half ago. And then my jaw just kept dropping. It was like, this is not at all the show that I thought it was going to be. But I'm glad, Simon, you were able to come on, because you speak to this subject so well. And in fact, when you're not around, and one of us has to play bad cop, we'll say it in our private chat room. We'll say, "I guess it's time for me to channel Simon." And so today, I got this in the public chat room. I say, "Simon's channeling Simon."
I wouldn't want to always be considered that way, because there's some people who are doing fantastic work. It's just that you don't seem to invite me on the show when they're on.
Well, it's all timing. It's all a matter of timing. You know, it's
all a matter of timing. But anyway, we all make mistakes, and you know, we live and learn. The company that acquired InstallShield and then went on to acquire the last mortal remains of Palomita turns out not to be a real member of our community.
Yeah. Well, like I said, maybe some things that we said will at least start the conversation for them at their company, because, like I said, even if it's just open core, that's still a step up, and they already have a service model for how they can charge people for their M&A audits and all that sort of stuff. So it seems like a real good possible company about that. So anyway, let's talk about who's coming up, and hopefully all of these are a little better for the show. And I thank you guys, if you're still listening to this show, thank you for having made it all the way through. So next week is Railroader, which is a security analysis, static analysis tool for finding vulnerabilities in applications that use Ruby on Rails. Speaking of automated tools that are open source to find security audits, right? Fluid Keys builds an open PGP and makes it easy to implement great security across your organization. EddySync is secure, end-to-end encrypted, and privacy-respecting sync for your contacts, calendars, and tasks. Mycroft is the world's first open source assistant. Think of like Alexa or Google Assistant. Mycroft runs anywhere, almost anywhere actually, on a desktop computer, inside an automobile, or on a Raspberry Pi. And it's an open source software which can be freely remixed, extended, and improved. Mycroft can be used in anything from a science project to an enterprise software application. Boy, that sounds like fun. Ionic. The Ionic Framework is the free open-source mobile UI toolkit for developing high-quality cross-platform apps for native iOS, Android, and web, all from a single code base. And me being a Flutter advocate, I want to be really interested in how that particular show goes. Redis said that they had some updates since they were last on a few years ago, and that's an open-source BSD-licensed in-memory data structure store. Uses a database, cache, and message broker. And I believe we're using Redis here at ZipRecruiter. So, but that's who I got coming up, and all those sound a lot more straightforward in today's show. You can go to the big spreadsheet, twit.tv/floss. If you have any other suggestions, please tell the project leader or the community coordinator to email me, especially if it's not cryptocurrency or blockchain. We've had enough of those for a while. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. I was at Scale the past week. I met about 10 potential guests, so we just need to do the paperwork and get that all put together. I will be in Philadelphia at the Cloud Foundry Summit, April 2 through 4, at their invitation, by the way, which is really cool. So the CNCF has been actually inviting me to various conferences and paying for parts of it, which is really nice. I'll be at the Pro Conference, also known as YAPSE, in mid-June, and it's sort of my upcoming thing. Simon, anything you want to plug?
Not really. I've got a bunch of travel coming up that's to do with the Document Foundation and OSI. And I'm always excited to have people in the places I'm going to wave and say hi. If you're in the Bay Area, I'm going to be there in week 13. If you're in Florida, I'm going to be there in week 14. If you're in New York, I'm going to be there in week 19. And I would love to hear from any listeners and viewers, and maybe share a caffeinated beverage with you in one of the places you're going. You'll find me all over the place as Webmink. I'm Webmink on Twitter. I am Webmink at gmail.com. And I'm also at webmink.com. And if you're watching on the video, you can see the URL for my company down there in the banner.
Cool. Well, Simon, again, perfect co-host for this show. I really appreciate your insight and your ability to try to clarify what the actual issue is around not having something be open source. So I appreciate that.
It's my pleasure. And I'll have to go and practice some meditation and relaxation now.
Go take a nap. Go do something. Yep. All right. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.